From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with baritone Cheryl Milnes. He sung with the Metropolitan Opera for nearly 20 years and performed with many of the world's leading opera companies. Also today, I talk with horror writer Clive Barker. He made his directorial debut with Hellraiser, a new horror movie about a secret world of pleasure and pain. Critic at large Laurie Stone examines the TV shows Werewolf and Beauty and the Beast and what they say about sexual fantasies in the age of AIDS. And accordionist Guy Klusevic performs an excerpt from Polkas from the Fringe, which he's about to perform at New Music America. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest, Cheryl Milnes, is one of the world's leading operatic baritones. Since 1965, he sung with the Metropolitan Opera. While praising his strong voice, critics have also taken note of his rugged good looks. Milnes has been called the king of the Italian baritones, although his background is American heartland, having grown up on a dairy farm in Downers Grove, Illinois. He's best known for his interpretations of Verdi and Puccini, and he's currently preparing to sing Puccini's Tosca at the Met and at the Opera Company of Philadelphia. Before I speak with Cheryl Milnes, let's listen to an excerpt of the Te Deum from Tosca. Milnes sings the role of Scarpia, the evil chief of police. Niccolo Rescinio conducts the National Philharmonic and the London Opera Chorus. Cheryl Milnes is joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. Cheryl Milnes, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
You're preparing to sing Tosca with the Met and with the Opera Company of Philadelphia. You've sung it many times. How do you prepare to do a role again that you've done a lot before?
Well, to a certain degree, you have to wait until you work with your colleagues, because a lot of what you do is determined by the reaction of your colleagues. Not so much the tenor Cavaradossi in this case, because Scarpia's relationship to him is very clear. They are on opposite sides of the political fence in 1800 Rome. But how the Tosca reacts determines very much what the scopia does. Also, the sound of your voice and your physical appearance sets up certain elements that you can't change. Your voice sounds as your voice sounds, and so scopia has to have that voice. You can't use somebody else's voice or change the color enormously.
You grew up on a dairy farm in Downers Grove, Illinois. Is a farm background uncommon in the opera world?
I suppose, yeah. Milking cows and making hay and all those down and dirty things is not the normal opera singer background, although I guess the work ethic part serves you well throughout your life.
How were you exposed to opera?
Well, very atypical, untypical farm life. My mother was a piano teacher, church choir director. So music was, in fact, a part of our family everyday life. And I was brought up in church music. All the oratorios, Bach cantatas and hymns and so forth. Opera was kind of a late listening experience, although we did listen on Saturday afternoons to the Met broadcasts when we were near a radio. So I suppose in hearing, opera wasn't so unusual, but to see it or ever think about singing opera as a career, that was very far from my thoughts. But music as a part of my life was very normal.
Well, didn't you study about 6 or 7 different instruments plus voice when you were growing up?
Violin, piano, and in high school I learned to play jazz bass and played in dance bands all through high school and college.
Yeah, so all of that, and then you decided to go to pre-med school. I can't figure that out.
Well, that was 1 year's worth. I suppose to make a fairly complicated story somewhat simpler, because music had always been a part of my life, I thought of it more as an avocation rather than a vocation. And early on, when I was young, my uncle, my mother's brother, died of appendicitis. It was early enough. They had just discovered penicillin, but it was early enough so that it was not readily available. And he died needlessly in my mind when I found out about it after the fact. And somehow, as a little kid makes certain decisions, I thought that was such a terrible thing that my uncle would die of a disease that, when I found out about it, was no longer necessary. Penicillin was then available. That I somehow thought I wanted to be a doctor. You know, this is grade school time, junior high. I wanted to be a doctor, and that just kind of stayed with me. So I took heavy science curriculum in high school and then spent a year in pre-med. But what happened in pre-med, it's a very tough science, math, chemistry set of courses, and I had no time for music that 1 year. And when it was taken away from me, then I realized how important it was to me.
I think it's maybe very important to get away from music for a while so that you feel that you're making the decision to have your life be that musical as opposed to the decision having been preordained and you have no way out.
Yeah, there's something to that. Certainly, that year away, I felt a frustration internally because even going to choir rehearsal Thursday night and singing services Sunday morning was almost out, and I didn't play violin in a symphony that I had been playing for several years. Dance jobs, there just wasn't time. The homework load was too great. Well, during that year, at some point, I realized what frustration, this kind of void inside of me was, and it was the fact that I was being deprived of that which I loved more than the medicine, and that was music.
Baritone Cheryl Milnes is my guest. You got your start touring with Boris Goldovsky's opera company. Did that enable you to establish yourself in America without having to go to Europe first?
Well, certainly. I don't know that I would use the word establish. That probably took a little more time, city opera years and early years at the Met to really establish. But certainly the Goldovsky experience allowed me to improve, allowed me to become good enough in America to go on to a big career. 300 performances over 100,000 miles over a dozen different roles all over this country that's the kind of experience that people will often go to Germany to get, one of the small German houses.
Now, that company used to, the way I understand it, travel by bus across the country and perform in many places that didn't have resident opera companies.
Well, in fact, they performed everywhere that didn't. And in the 60s, which we're talking about, there were far fewer regional companies than exist now. Much has happened in the last couple of decades. And all the operas were in English, and no super titles, whatever. We had to. Boris beat up on us if our diction wasn't good enough. And, well, Tosca was one of those that I sang in English the first time.
Was that good experience, singing in English first and not having to worry about mastering a new language as you're getting your voice in shape?
Oh, absolutely. From two points of view, I think. Vocal technique, what you were saying, you don't have to add the other problem of the language mastery, but also specific and exact stage movements, because you knew what you were saying. You didn't have to think of a translation because it was your language. You did movements, you did gestures, you did emotional reactions to your colleagues' words at precisely the right time because you understood every nuance, past tense, future tense, subjective, and so forth. Then when you, in a sense, graduated to the original language, graduated in the sense of certainly the contours, the flow of it as the composer originally intended is better. There is a gain and a loss. There is a gain of clarity in English when the singers make good diction. But there is a loss of the flow because the composers wrote melodic lines and sweep to go with a certain set of sounds. But when you went to the original language, then what you did on stage was far more specific. You didn't just gesture sometime in these two or three measures. You were precise, and the punch, the sharp edges of the character stayed.
Do you ever wish you could sing more in English when you do foreign operas?
Well, there's also the problem of the audience. Now I don't sing as often for the uninitiated. For the initiated, mm-hmm. The original language has clarity and sharp edges, as I said before, and they're used to those sounds, the international audiences, yeah. the major houses around the world. Sometimes, for instance, Hamlet, which I have been doing in the last several years, I've done that both in French and in English. Well, because Hamlet, as the opera in French, is in fact a translation from Shakespeare's English, doing it in English is in a way the more original. Also, it's a great play, as we know, and the audience can follow it much more clearly. When I did the Hamlet in English, it felt as though I was doing a Shakespearean play, whereas in French, it's grand French opera that is somewhat related to Shakespeare.
I'd like to get back for a moment to your early touring with the Boris Goldovsky Company. You went to a lot of places that many singers might have considered the sticks because it wasn't New York. I think from your background, you wouldn't have condescended to the places and the audiences you were going to because you weren't a native New Yorker yourself. You were from a farm background.
Yes, I didn't consider any of the places we sang at all irregular or... first of all, it was what the tour schedule said. We were scheduled to sing, and he would do as many as six a week, and there was a double cast. So you sang every other performance, whether it was every other day or every third, fourth day, depended on the schedule. Also, there is an odd thing. When you are in a set, let's say a Tosca set, when you're actually doing singing, playing Scarpia in the performance, you could be anywhere in the world because the set is the same set in any city. When you're in the hotel, when you're walking around the town, whatever, then it has its own characteristics. But when you are on stage, it almost doesn't matter, if you understand what I mean. It almost doesn't matter where you are, even now in the big leagues. You could be in London or Paris or Vienna or Scala, Milano. If it was a production that you knew, when you're in the set, you could be in any of those cities and it really wouldn't matter.
I want to talk with you more about your life, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is baritone Cheryl Milnes. We'll talk some more after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Baritone Cheryl Milnes is my guest. Before we talk some more, let's listen to an excerpt of him singing the Eddie II from Verdi's Un ballo in Mascara. Cheryl Milnes, you sing a lot of Verdi. Did he write especially well for baritones?
Yes. Verdi, in fact, treated the baritone voice in a special way, differently than the bel canto composers before him, and certainly Mozart or Bach, Handel, the Baroque composers. He wrote a higher tessitura line, higher lying line, and a fatter orchestration underneath it. And he, in a sense, he forced baritones of the time and subsequent generations to almost find a new technique, a new way to sustain the high notes. And I suppose over a period of time that the phrase Verdi baritone developed. You have to be able to sit with Fs, F-sharps, Gs, A-flats, sometimes A-naturals.
What's the difference between the operatic life of a tenor and a baritone?
Oh, we're normal. Everyone knows that.
No, but did you ever feel that...
Are you listening, Placido and Luciano?
Do you ever feel that the baritone's life is significantly different than the tenor's life?
Well, you mean personal or vocal musical?
No, vocal musical. I can guess all the ways it would be different personally. No.
It's an interesting question. I think probably it is a fact that tenors sing proportionately higher in their range than baritones and basses. They sing more high notes in a given role than baritones sing the same relative high notes. If there's a minor third difference in a baritone and a tenor, and that's an approximate fact, that means for every G a baritone has in an opera, a tenor has a B-flat. There are many more B-flats written for tenors than there are Gs for baritones. Lots of roles don't have Gs. Sometimes G-flat or F-sharp is the highest. Tenors have B-naturals and Bs and then interpolate Cs, although some of the bel canto composers wrote Cs. So they're playing their skills a little closer to their limit, which is probably one of the reasons that in history of opera, I think tenors and sopranos are, all other things being equal, are more famous than mezzos, baritones, and basses. How's that for an answer?
That's pretty good. Are there roles that you wish you could sing but you can't because it's not in your range?
Well, I suppose there are times that there's no nagging... permanent frustration about a given part that I would die to sing. But so many parts, I mean, Otello is a powerful melding of drama and words and music, voice. Anyone would, I think, love to be able to sing Otello. But, of course, Iago is not a throwaway part exactly either, and it's fun. Baritones are often the bad guys, and, of course, Otello, what I just mentioned, Iago, who's probably a psychotic bad guy, whereas Scarpia, a very different, he's a smart bad guy, violent,
I bet
mean.
Bad guys are the most fun to play. Really?
Well, certainly I think it's more interesting, the part of Scarpia is more interesting as a character than the part of Cavaradossi. He's the idealist, but he usually sings of love or some kind of idealistic emotion, whereas the baritone can vacillate between, well, real love, anger, jealousy. The soprano always loves the tenor somehow, and the baritone is the toi of menage a toi. And he always loses, or almost always.
But I'm sure that doesn't affect your personal life.
No, stage is one thing.
That's right.
Off stage is something else.
I want to ask you one more thing about your early career. I know when you were getting started, you used to record some commercials. Who did you do commercials for?
Well, you mean products?
Product commercials, yeah.
The two big Saturation Time Network products were Schlitz beer and Marlboro cigarettes. Perfect things for singers.
Which jingles were there? They've had so many.
You mean on the air I can do that?
Well, actually, you could, yeah.
You get a lot to like with a Marlboro filter, flavor pack, or box, courtesy of Scarpia. Or, there's just one Schlitz, yeah, yeah, nothing else comes near. When you're out of Schlitz, you're out of beer. And so forth.
Oh, what a different
Kellogg's
voice.
Cornflakes and Oklahoma gasoline. I think that company was bought out. But Oklahoma, I said, Oklahoma will put a tiger in your tank. A lot of stuff. That was fun. I suppose that was an outgrowth of the jazz bass playing all through high school and college and the pop stuff. I used to croon.
Yeah, well, you sure sing those commercials in a different voice than you sing your opera parts.
Well, that was one of the reasons that I was able to get in with the group. This was all in Chicago, by the way. And they found that, first, I could sight read. Second, I could use a very pop sound. I could use a medium pop sound, or I could use a very zingy kind of barroom, unrefined sound. But you want a macho sound for some of these things, but you don't want it to sound refined. And I could change as we found the sound that seemed to say the right thing for that product. And so during the 60s, even in the early 70s, I did a lot of stuff at Universal Studios in Chicago.
Were you hedging your bets in case you never made it in opera?
No, I didn't think of it hedging. I just thought it was good hustling. Because, as you know, if a product is used on network TV or radio, there can be a lot of money involved.
Right.
I mean, tens of thousands of dollars, even back then. Now, I guess it's even hundreds of thousands. But I missed out on the hundreds of thousands. But.
Baritone Cheryl Milnes is my guest. There was a hiatus in your career a few years ago when you ruptured a capillary in your throat, and that went undiagnosed for a while. And I think for a while you were quite afraid about what was happening to your voice.
I suppose panic would be a better word.
Did that make you think about what you'd want to do when you retire from singing?
Yes, although, I mean, certainly it focused in various thoughts, although I think I've been singing 22 years at the Met, 27 years in a career. I think after the first 10, 15 years of a career, one does start to look down the road, because the older singers at the Met, when I first went there, you start to see them retiring out slowly and doing other things or not doing other things. And because I have always enjoyed teaching, I do master classes around the country and in Europe too, for that matter, have for a long time and continue to do them more and more and more. And I think that certainly is a direction that I will go, and during that time of, wasn't exactly a hiatus, but there, I canceled 3 months at the Met and certain other performances. It does. Panic has a way of moving you in another direction.
Fires you up. Well, outside of family, is a throat doctor one of the people closest to any opera singer?
Well, sure. In a word, yes, because that is such a personal relationship. I have an old Viennese doctor in New York. Actually, two doctors. Dr. Reckford and Dr. Gould, both, which kind of combines the best of America and the best of Europe. But Dr. Reckford is 80-some years old and practiced medicine, voice in Vienna before the Second World War. And he, from his memory, you get a procession of names that he knew and whose throats he worked on. I mean, way before Corelli, Del Monaco, who were his clients, but people from the 20s and 30s. It's unbelievable to talk to him about voice.
I'm not sure who did the calculations, but it has been computed that you have become the most recorded opera singer ever in America. I hope this means that you enjoy recording.
Well, there's no doubt of the advantage of recording because the records can precede you and follow you and be there while you're there, and it's a little like movies where the movie star is being seen all over the world simultaneously. We're being heard all over the world simultaneously. Actually, I find recording difficult, though, to get in the sound some kind of the visual energy that one sees in a performance, or hopefully sees in a performance, to get that on the sound alone. That is a big challenge. Also, to do it in a studio, which is more sterile by its nature. You don't have an audience to react to and with. I find recording difficult. I seem to pour out more in order to get it all in the sound than perhaps on stage when the eye and the ear are working together.
Well, I enjoy your recordings, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us today about your life.
Been a pleasure.
This is Cheryl Milnes singing the role of Iago from Otello. He's joined in a duet by Placido Domingo as Otello.
Estimone, soglio mio, ben rara in anima, l'ampia terra in vasto spiro, del creato in terre, per Otello e a sacro ardente, braccia d'anima, santo erore e cruenti, sarmi a soffer, si legge il cuore a tua, la morte sta e morì,
My guest has been Cheryl Milnes. He's a world-renowned operatic baritone who makes his home at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with economist John Kenneth Galbraith, so I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, writer-turned-film director Clive Barker gives a glimpse into his world of horror. Barker's new film, Hellraiser, features sadomasochistic creatures from another dimension. Critic at large Laurie Stone examines the sexual overtones of two new TV shows, Werewolf and Beauty and the Beast. And accordionist and composer Guy Klusevic performs an excerpt of Polkas from the Fringe, an ongoing project featuring polkas he's commissioned from pop and new music composers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Ann Bozell in Washington. A $300 billion defense bill passed by the Senate today is heading toward a conference committee and then perhaps toward a presidential veto. The Senate passed the measure today by a vote of 56 to 42, but lawmakers tacked on at least two amendments which President Reagan doesn't like. One of those, co-sponsored by Arkansas Senator Dale Bumpers, would demand that the U.S. comply with the unratified SALT II Treaty.
The whole impetus and thrust of the Bumpers, Leahy, Chafee, Hines Amendment was that we did not think it was a good idea to have absolutely no constraints on the nuclear arms race after both sides for 5 years had complied.
The second measure would stop Reagan administration efforts to speed up the timetable for the Star Wars missile defense program. It would require that the U.S. continue to abide by the traditional interpretation of the anti-ballistic missile treaty. An angry President Reagan today charged that opponents of Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork are trying to pack the high court.
Our founding fathers intended the courts to be above partisan politics, but in the last few weeks, we've seen an attempt to turn the confirmation of a justice into a partisan issue. No expense has been spared, and we all know the reason. A few special interests consider the courts their private preserve.
In a break from his colleagues, Democratic Senator David Boren said today that he will vote to confirm Bork, but Republican Senator Richard Lugar says the votes are not there for the Supreme Court nominee. Lugar says Bork's confirmation now depends more than ever on Mr. Reagan's powers of persuasion, but he says it's doubtful the president will be able to turn people around. The Speaker of Iran's parliament made his most scathing attack yet on the United States today, and Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani told Iranian youth to prepare for war. Tim Fluellen has details.
The Iranian speaker, one of the most powerful of Iran's leaders, chose the traditional platform of Friday prayers, a political more than a religious occasion in Iran, to issue his challenge to the United States. If our youth and ourselves are due to be martyred, he told the chanting worshippers, it's sweeter for us to have a direct confrontation with the United States. It would, in the end, mean peace for Muslims. And it would, he said, mean that Iran was fighting the real instigator of the war with Iraq, the Americans. Iraq was the monkey, he said, but America was the organ grinder, and it was now firmly in Iran's sights. These tough words have not so far been reflected in Iranian tactics in the Gulf, where the Iranian Navy and Revolutionary Guards are retaliating against Iraqi strikes by attacking shipping using Arab ports, but avoiding the United States Navy.
The BBC's Tim Fluellen. The Turkish government says a break in diplomatic relations between Iran and Iraq is imminent. It announced today that both countries have asked Turkey to look after their interests in each other's capital cities. The nation's jobless rate dropped below 6% in September, the first time it's been that low since President Reagan took office. In testimony today before the Joint Economic Committee, the Commissioner of Labor Statistics, Janet Norwood, says she expects the downward trend to continue.
The unemployment rate has been trending downward for some time now. I don't know what will happen in the future, but I'm quite encouraged in what has happened. We've come down 1.1 percentage points over the last year. Employment growth has been considerable. I think that's very good.
Norwood said the service sector of the economy has been producing new jobs right along, but that last month the manufacturing sector also began to do so. Wall Street closed the week with a marginal advance. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained close to 2 points today to close out the week at 2640.99. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Guy Klisevic began playing the accordion when he was 6. He grew up in a Slovenian community in the coal mining country of western Pennsylvania, a breeding ground for traditional polka music. He performed for weddings and parties when he was in high school, but since then he's taken both the accordion and the polka in some surprising new directions. Klisevic will take part in the New Music America Festival, a national gathering of new music composers and musicians, which is just getting underway in Philadelphia. He'll perform his work Polkas from the Fringe, a collection of short polkas he commissioned from new music composers. This sounded interesting, so we asked him to join us for this week's performance segment.
I decided to kick off Polka from the Fringe with a piece of my own, and it's called The Grass It Is Blue, subtitled Ain't Nothing But a Polka. And it turns out that this piece has a lot of references to musics that I've been listening to for years and that I've been playing as a performer for years as a professional. The most obvious influence in style is bluegrass music, but you'll also hear some quotes from George Gershwin, which are I used to play arrangements of his as a kid. You'll hear a little bit of Elvis in the vocal part, and you'll hear a little New Orleans rhythm and blues bass music. You'll hear a little of African rhythmic influence, some quotes from Terry Riley's In C, 2001, Jaws, and at the end, just to keep everybody happy, a little of Three Blind Mice. That was The Grass It Is Blue, subtitled Ain't Nothing But a Polka, and it's a piece that I wrote in 1986. Christian Markley is a composer and an improviser whose instrument is the turntable. And having improvised with him quite a bit in groups with John Zorn, I got to know and like his music very much. And his contribution to the Polka from the Fringe is called Ping Pong Polka. It's got a lot of beginnings, a lot of middles, and a lot of ends, and a lot of holes where I play an accordion solo part. This is a recording of Ping Pong Polka by Christian Markley. Thank you. What you just heard was an excerpt from Christian Marklay's Ping Pong Polka. This is Guy Klusevic. I was the accordionist on that track.
Guy Klusevic lives in Brooklyn, New York. Here's some more polka music written by Carl Finch. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry.
What stories are you following?
We're following the debate over sanctions against South Africa. Also, the 15th anniversary of the ABM Treaty, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, a big report by Kathleen Dolansky. We'll have an interview about the history of economics, and also we'll talk about this week's economics with Jimmy Vaccaro.
Who is Jimmy Vaccaro?
Jimmy Vaccaro sets the odds on the pro football games for the Golden Nugget in Las Vegas. And as you know, figuring out the odds on the football games this weekend is more difficult than usual since nobody knows the guys who are playing.
Right. Thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Two hairy creatures have become primetime stars. Our critic at large, Laurie Stone, says hidden messages about sexuality and AIDS lurk in their shadows. She has these thoughts about the Fox television program Werewolf and the new CBS series Beauty and the Beast.
There hasn't been an avenging monster on the tube since the early 70s, when the Incredible Hulk sank forever into the primordial ooze. But right now, hairy-knuckled monsters are featured on two series, Werewolf and Beauty and the Beast. What's fresh is that the monsters, at once victims and gladiators, aren't imagined as aliens lurking in bogs. They've come in from the cold. They're us. Werewolf begins on an intriguing note. A young man is attacked out of the blue and turned into a werewolf. He describes his condition as an irreversible illness. He explains that an implacable urge whelms up, preceded by the sign of a bleeding pentagon on his palm. The mark conjures herpes, the doomed condition suggests AIDS, and the driving impulse signals sex, red in tooth and claw. As in David Cronenberg's remake of The Fly, the implied comparison of monstrous transformation with AIDS creates a bubbling cauldron of projections. Both The Fly and the werewolf begin innocent and unwitting, but once stricken, they turn into murderers, fiends without scruples or the power to control their blood hungers. I'm afraid I don't care anymore, each admits, venting our most sordid terrors about the HIV virus and those carrying it. Alas, werewolf's provocative ideas prove all growl and no fang. The series is a dreary, unscary mess, and the illness metaphor degenerates into a means of simply making the doomed man pitiable. But Beauty and the Beast shows more sustained imagination, and this program is one of the weirdest ever to surface. Catherine, a rich girl lawyer, is attacked and slashed, Marla Hansen style. She's rescued and nursed by Vincent, a man-beast of mysterious origins who lives in a tunnel community deep, deep within Manhattan's bowels. He reads Dickens aloud, then sends her home. But because he has empathic powers and can sense her danger, he comes to her rescue when brutes get the better of her again. The above-ground sequences have grit, and as Catherine, Linda Hamilton comes off as a believable 80s woman weaned on feminism. It's the fantasy stuff that sticks in the craw. Like Werewolf, this show is a cautionary tale. Werewolf says, you thought you could screw around, but now you see it kills you. Beauty and the Beast tells women, you thought you could live independently, but now you see you get cut. The creators of this show aggressively seek to please women. Ron Perlman, who plays Vincent, sums it up. quote, "The beast is every woman's ideal fantasy figure. He's filled with love and gentleness and nobility, and he makes no sexual demands," unquote. That's not the case in either the original fairy tale or in Jean Cocteau's movie version, but here the beauty turns from real men to Vincent, a being utterly lacking in libido, a creature who is said to resemble a lion, but in reality looks like a giant rabbit with David Lee Roth's hair. Excuse me, but is this really what women want? Book chats and rescues? Even if you're into protection, surely the equalizer who has sexual dynamism is preferable. Personally, I'm into a rough beast who meets me in the basement and dispatches the laundry. Men can make it with mermaids, but no nookie with supernaturals for girls. Catherine hugs the beast, but never do her lips touch fur. She doesn't know what she's missing, as I, a dog lover, can testify. In the age of AIDS, wouldn't Virgin Victor be a safe bedfellow? I say, let the girl have the beast and let the beast act like an animal. Do it for their health.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic and is a contributor to The Village Voice. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with actress Betty White. She's worked in television since its early days and now stars in the NBC series The Golden Girls. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead will review Shades, pianist Andrew Hill's first album in 6 years. And television critic David Bianculli will review Star Trek, The Next Generation, the latest version of the science fiction adventure. So I hope you can join us, and we'd like to hear from you. Our address is Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, Independence Mall West, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton are the production assistants. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.